Who was William Button, and how does he overlap the life of Andrew Fuller? Fuller aficionados may recollect the name William Button, or some variation of his name, on the title page of a number of Fuller's publications. Button is listed either as a bookseller of Fuller or as his publisher or both. But William published numerous other books and pamphlets for his Baptist brethren in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Button was more than simply a seller and publisher of important literature. He was a Baptist leader in his own right, and his life is worthy of this brief examination. The life of William Button is not as easy as one might expect, given the frequency with which his name appears on Baptist literature, if not in it. To date, the only biographical sketch of his life and career seems to be a two-part essay that followed on the heels of his death in mid-1821. An examination of important works of British Baptist history only reveals scattered and brief comments about the man William Button, with just a smattering here and there of his role in Baptist life. This essay will supply this want of information and gather together in one place what may be known of the elusive Mr. William Button. The task of biography is made more difficult because while William played a fairly significant role in English Baptist history, there does not appear to be any extant collection of his personal papers, despite the fact that his anonymous biographer had access to a personal journal at the time of his death. The material now seems lost to history. So the data for William Button is gleaned from a variety of sources. One of the chief sources is he was the publisher of the Baptist magazine for the first 10 years of its existence. Button was born in Pease Marsh, near Rye in Sussex, on March 5, 1754. His grandfather, John Button, was a Presbyterian and a farmer who, toward the end of his life, became a Baptist. His father, James, was a farmer and a grazier, a mother, the daughter of a Mr. Vinney, a man of means in Tenderton and Kent, a pious and accomplished woman. Not long after William's birth, his father moved to Portsmouth and then moved again in 1761 to London, where he became engaged in a partnership with a Mr. Kemp, an upholsterer of Cornhill. Little is known of William's early childhood, save that he had, at the age of about five, he contracted smallpox, and it was feared that he would succumb to the disease. Despite the prognosis, he recovered but suffered the loss of sight in his right eye. His father eventually moved to Southwark, where James subsequently became a deacon in the Carter Lane Church of Dr. John Gill. In 1762, at the age of eight, William was placed in the care of John Collett Ryland of Northampton, under whose influence he began to learn of his spiritual needs. As a youth, he attended the funeral of a schoolmate and heard a sermon from a Mr. Gregg, which made a deep impression on his tender soul. It was the same sermon that God used to awaken the need in the heart of John Ryland, Jr. On Sunday, the 11th of September in 1767, both boys professed their faith before the elder Ryland's congregation, and the following Sunday they were admitted into fellowship via baptism. Later that day, they observed their first Lord's Supper. Not long after his baptism, William was tested spiritually, first in the death of his honored mother. Then his father's house burned to the ground. Being underinsured, James lost a considerable sum of money. These two events caused a great cloud of grief to hang over William's head. John Gill delivered the funeral sermon for Anna. The sermon, A Dejected Believer's Soliloquy from Psalm 42, was published years later in the earliest book to bear William's name as a publisher. That's the earliest book I've been able to find. By 1769, William was apprenticing with his father, whose business had expanded into the East and West Indies. The burden of work was heavy, and William often labored into the night. The pressure brought his spirits low and his health lower. He subsequently dropped from active church fellowship and avoided communion. In time, however, he began attending the preaching of William Clark of Unicorn Yard, and soon was received into membership of the Assembly. This association with Clark brought William a change of spirits and direction. He began to pursue his Christian life with vigor. Soon he was speaking in conference meetings, commenting on various passages of Scripture. Clark encouraged William and the church that William possessed ministerial gifts. The church concurred. He was invited to address the assembly for the first time publicly on a Monday evening. This successful first attempt at preaching was followed by several more months of mentoring by Clark, who would take a number of future ministerial students under his wing. Button's first public sermon came 6 months later when he addressed the Unicorn Yard congregation. The positive reception of the sermon led to invitations from London area ministers to fill their pulpits. At the behest of Wallen, Benjamin Wallen, Button was invited to supply at a church at Tile Street, Hitchin, Herefordshire, which was then without a pastor due to the untimely death of Samuel James. Button preached three times that day and subsequently received an invitation to fill a three-month stint with the church. Shortly before his anticipated departure to Hitchin, he received a letter from another group of believers then without a pastor. This group had lately separated amicably from the Carter Lane Church of the recently deceased John Gill. The group, which included Button's own father, a deacon under Gill, wished for William to serve as their pastor. Also among this small group was George Keith, the son-in-law to Gill, and the recent publisher of a series of sermons and tracts by the late Dr. Gill. This new fellowship of believers was unhappy with the choice of John Rippon, who succeeded the venerable Dr. Gill, and requested a separation to form a new congregation. Would William consent to be their pastor? This invitation threw William into a quandary. He was inclined to accept the initial offer from the Hitchin Church. Still, he had one significant problem. They adopted open communion. Button resolved to fulfill his pledge to minister for 3 months and hoped to remain among them if they surrendered their open view of the table. Button had been exhorted to remain true to the faith by Benjamin Wallen the day before his departure. Wallen made an impression on Button, for despite the warm reception he received at Hitchin and despite his apparent pulpit success, when the church refused to surrender their communion views, Button bid them a sorrowful farewell. In the meantime, the separatists from Carter Lane had not abandoned their desire to see Button minister among them. When they heard that William had returned to the city, doubtless from his father, James, the separatists immediately petitioned William to accept their previous invitation. William gladly accepted, but stipulated a 12-month trial period in the event that the church might have a change of heart. If so, he would release them from their call. The day following William's return, a meeting was held at Wallen's Maze Pond Church to recognize the new assembly as a separate body under the leadership of William Button. Among the ministers who gathered for the dedication service, in addition to Wallen, were Abraham Booth, Samuel Stennett, John Rippon, John McGowan, and of course, Button's mentor, William Clark. The new assembly planned to meet temporarily at Maze Pond on Sunday morning and at Miles Lane on Sunday evenings until a new chapel could be built at Dean Street some months later. The chapel was completed in November. The following July, Button was ordained. Among the ministers who examined his suitableness for ministry were his pastor, Clark, Stennett, Wallen, Booth, John Reynolds of Cripplegate, who had followed the esteemed John Brine as pastor, and Ryland Sr. Stennett led the proceedings, and Wallen also preached in addition to Clark. Although Button had chose Carter Lane over Hitchin's, one good thing came out of his time at Hitchin's. There he met Miss Anna James, the daughter of the deceased pastor. The two corresponded for 2.5 years before they were wed in 1776. At the Hitchin Church by the local Anglican rector, the church then being without a pastor. Eventually, they would have 9 children, only 3 sons who would survive and a daughter at his death in 1821. At this point, it becomes necessary to begin to trace the relationship between Button and the subject of our gathering, Andrew Fuller. When they first met is unknown to us, though doubtless Fuller, who was the same age as Button, traveled in similar and often overlapping circles. In 1775, Fuller was just beginning his first pastoral charge at Soham, a church that he had been baptized in at the age of 16. Just 2 months, he was ordained there in 1775, just 2 months before Button's own ordination at Dean Street. Initially, they likely did not work together because the two belonged to two different, geographically separate ministerial fellowships. However, on occasion, their paths crossed, and by the 1790s, Button would be publishing and distributing Fuller's materials in addition to supporting the work of the Baptist Missionary Society. Early in their relationship, Button opposed Fuller. at least in print. The event that put them on opposing sides was Fuller's 1785 treatise, A Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation. Button, doubtless under the shadow of John Gill, adopted a high Calvinist approach to the question of man's duty to embrace the gospel. Fuller had argued for duty faith. Men had the duty to believe in God, and thus the gospel could be freely proclaimed among them. It was worthy of all acceptation, though not all were equally drawn to Christ. Fuller was certainly no Arminian, but neither was he a staunch high Calvinist. Button responded to Fuller immediately in what could be described as a typical high Calvinist fare. In his introduction, he saw himself as an opponent to all things Arminian or anything that tended toward it, into which category the gospel worthy fell. Moreover, many who had taken up Fuller's cause had done so by attacking Gillism or Brynism, named for the two men, John Gill and John Bryan, whom Button esteemed very highly and felt were being unworthily maligned. The pamphlet took the shape of 13 letters to a friend. Button took his readers through the gospel worthy in detail, examining and refuting, at least in Button's mind, Fuller's argument, in keeping with the views of both Gill and Bryan. Fuller saw himself as a defender of the cause of God and truth, but Button saw him as a promoter of man and error. Button accepted Fuller's challenge to prove him wrong using the scriptures, citing numerous proof texts for his views. Button's style was caustic at times, noting that Fuller wrote out his sentiments and shared them with some friends. Button replied, "'Tis a pity he did not keep his thoughts to himself." Fuller answered Button and other critics of the gospel worthy in 1787. In doing so, he attempted to rise above the personalities involved and just deal with the theology at hand. It was the kind of back-and-forth exchange that was typical in the debate over strict views of Calvinism versus what would become Fullerism. However, Fuller and Button were not ministerial adversaries all of their career. There is no extant evidence that Button ever moved to Fuller's more generous soteriological views, and Fuller certainly never changed, but Button seems to have moderated his opposition to Fuller, at least for business purposes. While I've been unable to find any extant correspondence between them, at least from the 1790s forward, Button seems open to some form of relationship. Button becoming a major London source for Fuller's subsequent literature. From the beginning of Button's ministry at Dean Street, he had among his congregants George Keith, the son-in-law of the venerable Dr. Gill. Keith had preserved much of Gill's thought in print only the year before the new church gathered. Gill's two-volume Sermons and Tracts came out in 1773. While it's impossible to tell for certain, it seems quite likely that Keith is the most likely influence on the new pastor who took up the cause of bookselling and publishing. If you compare the lists of books that George Keith published and the lists of books that William Button published, their book business seemed to be duplicates, just separated by time. And I can't find evidence of this, but it almost looks as though William Button took over Keith's business, though there may not have been a formal relationship, but he did the same kind of printing as George Keith did. Most likely source. Another man in Button's near circle who was a bookseller was Isaac James, the brother of Button's wife. Button's biographer suggests that Button's entrance into the book business came in 1876, first as a seller. However, at least by 1778, Button had begun to sell books to the general public in sufficient quantities to be listed as a source for a printed title. The work that could be secured from Button was a publication of his deceased father-in-law. It was actually the fifth printing of a book, a pamphlet that coincidentally had been sold by George Keith previously. There's no record of all the titles Button sold in the late 18th and early 19th century, but there were numerous imprints with his name on them, many Baptist titles among them. For example, the two earliest Baptist histories were sold by Button, Ivamy and Adam Taylor. Both list Button as a seller of the book. Button made his debut as a publisher a few years later when he issued an octavo volume of sermons by the late John Gill, sermons on important subjects. There's a variety of sets of sermons by Gill. Keith published two volumes in 1773, added a third volume in 1778, Hardcastle published three volumes in 1814-15. The second of the Hardcastle editions was the 1790 volume that William Button had produced, which is virtually impossible to find. But that second volume of the Hardcastle edition was actually the 1790 edition, a reprint of Button's sermons and tracts. They included the funeral sermon. That took me forever to find the sermon. Button began selling Fuller's material in the late 18th century when he helped Fuller disseminate his treatise against Socinianism. Thereafter, until the end of Button's publishing and bookselling career, his name would be associated with Fuller in the distribution of Fuller's material. For example, he is listed as the seller of Fuller's sermon before the Baptist Association at St. Albans, 1796. He is listed as a source for Fuller's controversial essay against deism, which we heard a little bit about. Actually, we heard it last night from Michael Haken. I was sitting in on one of his lectures. Button was also listed as a source for Fuller's biography, about which we just heard about Samuel Pierce. Button's precise business relationship with Fuller at this point is unclear. At times, he is listed merely as a seller. At other times, when there's no publisher listed on the title page, it may suggest that he was the publisher also. Clearly, during the second decade of the 19th century, that should read first decade, Button was heavily involved in the publishing world with one or two of his sons. Sorry, that is the second decade, that's right. In fact, shortly after Fuller's death, Button and son published the important biography of Fuller done by John Ryland, about which we heard this morning, though Fuller's own Andrew Gunton, was the actual printer. There is one curious bit of extant evidence that suggests Button was more than simply a seller of Fuller's material, but that he had a hand in publishing the pamphlets as well. And it's an odd book list, a catalog of books published. Notice it says published by William Button, and it lists a number of Fuller's titles in there, in addition to Luther on Galatians or Table Talk, Edwards' Faithful Narratives, and a variety of other books. Among the Baptists whom Button published, in addition to Fuller, were Robert Hall Jr., Abraham Booth, Rippins, the Baptist Register, Kinghorn, Ryland, Stennett, and James Dorr. While Button opposed Fuller's gospel worthy early in their relationship, Button himself did not let this become a permanent cause of separation between them. He was active in the British Baptist life in and around London at the same time Fuller and Carey were moving toward the formation of the Baptist mission movement. At some point, Button joined the effort. Evidence of this is suggested from several sources. First, Button is listed in John Rippon's Baptist Register as an authorized agent for the receiving of funds of the Baptist Mission Society. Stop the tape here. There's a picture in our brochure of the founders of the movement. I was trying to find out if all of those characters are designated as to who those people are, and if that's, you know, at what point exactly. He's not in the first meeting, but early on he joins the cause. Rippon published The Charge of Andrew Fuller in 1793 and a letter signed by a group of ministers at the dedicatory prayer. Well, Button does not seem to have been present at the Leicester dedication. His name appears at the end of the letter among a list of Baptist ministers who were authorized to receive funds for the missionary endeavor. A second source of clear evidence of his involvement with Fuller's missionary enterprise is the record of the departure of a later wave of helpers. In 1800, Francis Cox, the early historian of the movement, of the missionary movement, states that Button was among a group of Baptist ministers present at Gravesend for the send-off of Joshua Marshman and William Ward and their colleagues in 1800. These men had been commissioned for the missionary work at Prescott Street in London, the church pastored by Abraham Booth, who gave the new missionaries their charge. Button was joined by Sutcliffe and Andrew Fuller to bid adieu to the new missionaries as they departed to join Carey in India. The new mission led Baptists into wider cooperation, which subsequently led to the formation of the Baptist Union, with which Button was intimately involved. In addition to duties at Dean Street and his business as a bookseller, Button was quite active in Baptist affairs generally in and around London. He participated at various levels of life, including associational efforts and larger prospects. For example, during the 1790s, he regularly attended and ministered at the particular Baptist monthly meetings. You can read through Rippon's registers and see the actual lists of who's doing what, and year after year after year, Button hosts the meeting one year, he preaches at the meeting another year, he leads in prayer, or he moderates during each one particular month. He also participated in the ordination of Joseph Swain, a member of Carter Lane who had been called to the Walworth Church, and at the ordination of William Newman as he began his ministry at Old Ford in 1794. He offered the ordination, the Dean Street Chapel hosted the meeting of members of the Baptist Academical Institution at Stepney in 1810. And finally, Abraham Booth's well-known sermon on the word Amen. It was a series of sermons done on the Lord's Prayer. It's a great sermon, by the way, if you haven't read it. And that sermon was preached in the Dean Street Church. That Button was pastor, the Dean Street Chapel. Button also held a wider position within denominational life, acting as the secretary of the General Union of Baptist Ministers and Churches, which began in 1813. Button was joined in his duties with Ivamy. His eyesight began to fail. Ivamy took over, but Button remained connected till his death in 1821. Button's business continued to grow and perhaps to thrive. In the early 1800s, he was joined by one or more of his sons, either Samuel James or William Jr. The business churned out a number of important Baptist contributions. He published a limited number of significant non-Baptist materials. Among these publications are those items by or about Andrew Fuller. The final Fuller piece handled by the father and son was the Ryland Biography in 1818, and because the business closed in 1819. In 1814, Button and his brother-in-law, Isaac James, had traveled to the mainland. He had some eye problems. I'm going to skip that. In fact, I'm going to skip those next two paragraphs here, and I'm going to get down to about the middle of the bottom paragraph. On September the 11th, William resigned from his beloved church. The church had been, when he got back from this trip to the continent, there was problems with some of the leadership, and they were not very nice to him, and he resigned. And so he took a trip out to Sussex for a change of scenery. The church met to consider his resignation and letter, and petitioned him to continue. Upon his return, Button notified the church that as the situation which precipitated the resignation remained unaltered, he declined to continue with the assembly. Despite his withdrawal from Dean Street, he remained active in Baptist life, publishing a defense of strict communion. In the introduction, Button provided a nice summary of the debate. As Button's life began to draw toward a close, he experienced perhaps his most difficult personal trial. The business that he had started more than 30 years earlier, more than half of which time he labored with one or more of his sons, fell into hard times that necessitated them to declare bankruptcy. Up to the point of the collapse, they were publishing Baptist literature, but by 1819, the business could simply no longer pay its bills. In November, Button and Son filed for dissolution and attempted to pay off their creditors. It must have been an unhappy affair for Button. It also took a personal toll on his reputation. Sometime during this unfortunate trial, Button laid out the circumstances of the business failure before a group of friends, including some of his London ministerial colleagues. After careful consideration, the group affirmed Button's personal integrity and drafted a testimonial absolving him of financial improprieties. But the loss of his business placed him in severe pecuniary hardship. The gathered friends rose to the occasion and pledged an annuity in the amount of £500 to alleviate his plight. The exact nature of the financial crisis has not been discovered. It is clear that William's son, William Jr., bore the blame. This does not seem to be a matter simply of poor business decisions. Apparently, Jr. had a more unfortunate role in the affair. Without recording the details, Button's friend and fellow London pastor Joseph Ivamy recorded the circumstances. I'd like to read this. A solid, judicious minister, William Button, and a worthy man, but his engagements in business were very prejudicial to the success as a minister. In his last years, he was brought into great pecuniary difficulties by the conduct of two of his sons, who he did not properly control. The writer will not soon forget how emphatically he expressed the sentence not long before his death, the tears rolling down his cheeks, "I have committed Eli's sin, and I have received Eli's punishment." Incidentally, Ivamy records the affair in 1830 in volume 4 of his History of the English Baptist, he says, in effect, "We all know what happened to him, so rehearsing the details we don't need to do," and then just simply gives the lesson to be learned. It seems that only William Jr. was in business with the elder Button at the end, but according to Ivamy, whose church William attended during after his resignation, at least one other of the three sons also contributed to his father's problems. 10 years later, Ivamy used the account as an object lesson for others in the ministry. It should be seen as a warning to ministers, quote, who have accepted a pastoral office, how they engage in a business which requires constant attention and vigilant superintendence. They had better cast their families upon the care of divine providence than to adopt such means for their support. There are but few men who are capable of performing two things so very dissimilar as studying for the pulpit and conducting a large book-selling business. Either office, as Good Latimer expressed it, requiring more than half a man. It is inspired advice which ought not to be trifled with. Give thyself wholly to it. Button's final days occurred in mid-1890, 1821. On the morning of July 21, he set out to visit a sister in Hackney. En route, he slipped on a board crossing a body of water and fell in. He was rescued by a stranger who assisted him to the sister's house where he got dry clothes. However, it was soon evident that he had suffered some form of a stroke. Despite initial signs that he might recover, his condition worsened until July 31st when he lost most of his strength and mental faculties. He died peacefully 2 days later. His good friends, Ivamy and William Newton, presided at his funeral. He was buried in Bunhill Fields. Among the pallbearers were J.M. Cramp, who succeeded him at Dean Street, Ivamy, George Pritchard, the biographer of Ivamy, William Newton, James Hobie, a pastor at Maze Pond, the nonconformist Alexander Fletcher, and Joseph Stennett V. William Button.